From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Near the Tenderloin.
San Bruno.
North Sunnyvale.
Downtown Palo Alto. My beloved.
Redwood City.
On today's show, we're going to talk with Maurice Lim Miller, founder of the Family Independence Initiative and recent recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant for his innovative approach to fighting poverty.
So I'm in his office, and he asked, well, what would you do? And I said, well, I don't know what I would do, but my mother figured out how to get me out. And for that fact, I think most mothers and fathers would have a better idea how to help their own family.
We'll question the assumptions we often make about people without money.
The examples of success are embedded in these communities, but we'd never turn to them.
And think about learning, not teaching.
As long as we keep separating ourselves from, quote, them, we'll come up with different solutions because they're not us.
A conversation with Maurice Lim Miller today on Cross Currents. In 1999, Jerry Brown called Maurice Lim Miller at home. Brown was mayor of Oakland at the time, and Miller was on the board of an organization applying for more than $10 million for youth programs.
Most mayors you'd think would be really happy that we're bringing that kind of dollars into the city.
But Brown wasn't happy. He was upset. And after looking more closely at the proposal, Miller understood why.
We were going to create about 120 professional positions of social workers, administrators, et cetera. And then you go to the results. And what we were going to accomplish is we're going to enroll 80% of the toughest kids in Oakland and hope that they get jobs.
Hope the young people get jobs, but guarantee employment for middle-class professionals. That was why Brown didn't like the plan. Miller didn't like it either, but that's just how things were done. He wasn't sure how to do them differently.
So then he stopped the conversation. He said, really, what changed my life? He said, really, if you could do anything you wanted to do, money and regulations were not a problem, and you really wanted to impact poverty, because at that point, there'd been a 30-some-year war on poverty with really very little impact on poverty itself. Then he says, what would you do? And you show up at my office next month and show me.
Miller took Jerry Brown's challenge seriously. He'd grown up in poverty, and he understood what life was like for poor families. He'd also spent more than two decades working in social services. But the problem was immense, and it didn't seem to be getting better.
After 2 weeks, I came to the conclusion I didn't know how to impact poverty, but I had to show up at his office. So I'm in his office, and he asked, well, what would you do? And I said, well, I don't know what I would do, but my mother figured out how to get me out. And for that fact, I think most mothers and fathers would have a better idea how to help their own families. And so I would take some of this money you complain that we're spending on ourselves as professionals. I'd make it available to the families and pay them if they would show us how they would get their own families out.
This was the beginning of the Family Independence Initiative, an anti-poverty program that defies almost all of the conventional wisdom about how to help poor people move up the economic ladder. Miller recently won a MacArthur Genius Grant for his work, and he joins me in studio to talk about the basics, starting with what's wrong with the way we look at poor people.
There's a stereotype that low-income families don't know what to do. Otherwise, they would have gotten themselves out already. And so what I had to first do is prove that that stereotype was wrong. So what we do in that demonstration is we basically challenge the families to take over and come up with their own solutions. And my staff is told that if they give them any direction, any advice, any counseling, my staff is fired. And we've already fired four staff that couldn't help but be helpful. The issue is to really learn what families do for themselves.
So instead of this paternalistic attitude toward low-income people, which is we need to fix them and that will fix this, it was what can we learn from low-income folks about how they would get themselves to this next rung on the economic ladder?
What's happened over the last, now it's 47-year war on poverty, is that families have been acculturated to the fact that if they want resources, they have to do what the program tells them to do with the eligibility criteria. And we had that. We had one group of Samoan families come in and very directly say, okay, so what is it that you want us to do? You want us to, we see that you track housing. You want us to buy homes. You want us to, and they were really clear that they had to understand kind of what our, you know, our hoops were in order to get access.
What's your agenda?
Yeah. What's our agenda? And in many ways, people have been acculturated to do that. It doesn't mean that they accept it or whatever, but they think that's the only system. So all of a sudden, they're told, no, you can't get any direction from our staff because they're going to be fired. You're going to have to have a return to one another. And so what we do is we don't enroll individuals or individual families. We only enroll if they can bring in five or six other friends, other households together. And we basically say,
so
you're going to
network.
Have to turn to one another.
It right. sounds a little bit like the Grameen Bank policy on loans, microloans.
Right. It's interesting because this will be too long, but the Grameen Bank, really, the interesting part about it is the social network, not the loan.
Which is what everybody talks to you about. And if you're looking for a job or a professional network, right? Yeah. It's all about.
And we, if you're well off, you use your social networks tremendously for any new opportunities. You need a place, you call your friends, like you or your friends know of anything. So social networks. So basically we say, look, you're not going to get any direction from any professional staff, certainly not from FII. Therefore, you're going to have to turn to somebody. We don't think it's very easy to do it totally by yourself. Bring in five or six other households that are friends of yours already. And you have to turn to one another, and we're going to learn from you. So the two aspects of you're going to have to do it. Secondly, you're going to need a support system, which should be your friends. It's your community. Third is that you basically will be giving us data and information, and you're going to get feedback. You're going to see all the data that we have. So if your income goes up, you'll see it go up. If your debt goes down, you'll see it. And what we learned is that it's sort of like people have said, like Weight Watchers, where every month you see how you're doing. And it has a tendency to then reinforce what's right and make you aware and keep you focused. And families will say, you know, that the whole data reporting piece has really given feedback and it keeps them focused. And the fourth thing really is what we're learning needs to happen is that families need kind of a plethora of choices of things that they need when they need them, whether it's services or money or loans or whatever, so that they can build their lives the way they want to build their lives. So what we're finding is that every once in a while, they do need a social service. They need childcare. Childcare and things around their kids probably are one of the primary services that they really need. But again, they want to choose which childcare. Having one head start in their neighborhood does not address the problem. Their child may not fare well in that particular environment. And so they need choices. They need often loans, which again are not necessarily available. They need a reinforcing message that, you know, they really can figure their own way out. They don't need to wait for professionals, that they aren't lazy. They need encouragement. They need to have their initiative acknowledged. It's really interesting. Some of this is more around behavioral. It isn't even money. It isn't, you know, but the issue of they've been kind of put down for so long.
So you're talking about generational poverty here. People who have whose families have been in poverty that's been passed down generation after generation. And
yeah, it's interesting because we started with families around poverty level. Just, you know, we'd ask one family to recruit five or six of their friends, right? And you come in. And so their friends, you know, none of them had really wealthy friends. You know, so everybody was near poverty level. Some actually 40 or 50% were generally under the poverty level. The rest were maybe above poverty level, but all near that area. So it's pretty typical families that had to turn to services at one point or another, but services actually were a small part of what they needed. The primary barrier they have is that they're low income because they have less money. And having less money means you have fewer choices, and they had become more socially isolated. So their social networks were much more constrained, and so therefore they didn't have the networks that would give them opportunities to new jobs, new housing, new whatever. So that social isolation, economic isolation was the primary thing. It wasn't services per se. So as we moved along, then we were learning that we had to, you know, look at what were the resources that they needed. And some of it was really social networking. You know, could you then network with somebody? One of the stories that I think I learned a lot from was one woman had been in a car accident and called us up, and she wanted access to free legal services. So is there legal aid and whatever? Because that's how she'd been acculturated, as you call for social services when you have a problem. She said, you know, my insurance company's after me. My bank is after me. I need a lawyer. And we, you know, my staff is over there. Well, you know, that's not the primary thing that we do. And what we do is we're trying to learn about her social networks. And so we asked her, so do you know of any attorneys? And she said, no, otherwise I would have, you know.
Called them.
Right. And then I said, well, do you know of anybody else of your friends that have had car accidents that, again, had to turn to a lawyer and was successful? And she was thinking about it. It's like, no. Well, do you know of anybody who knows any whatever? It's like, well, no. So we kind of got to, well, in her network didn't seem to be any attorneys. And so then we were going to refer her to legal aid, right? And then she says, oh, but I babysit for an attorney. And all of a sudden, the light went off in her head. It's like, well, why don't I ask him? And we said, yeah. Why don't you ask him? And that the other thing to do is that, you know, what middle class people do is they when they ask for somebody, if they know some other attorney in that particular arena, say, can I use your name? Because everything is by name and social network. And that was the one thing she hadn't thought of. Right. So a lot of it's becoming aware of the social networks that you're in and then how to take advantage of them.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. I'm speaking with Maurice Lim Miller, founder of the Family Independence Initiative, about his innovative approach to anti-poverty work. Tell me exactly what the Family Independence Initiative did on the ground in Oakland.
Well, in Oakland sort of was the first experiment, and that was with the backing of Jerry Brown. And so what we did is we brought in two groups that ended up being primarily African-American, one primarily from East Oakland, one primarily from West Oakland. I say primarily mostly because we asked them to bring in their friends, and their friends aren't always in the same neighborhood. But we started with one family in West Oakland. They recruited, you know, another six or seven families. One lived in Berkeley, et cetera. It was, you know, you have your friends. We had one group that was Salvadoran refugee families. So they wanted to leave this country. They were here because of the war there. They didn't want to stay. They weren't the immigrant group that had all this hope about America. And then another one was the Mien community, which came out of the war in Vietnam. And again, they had to leave their country. They didn't have a written language. Almost all of them had been on welfare because they couldn't get jobs here because of language and everything else. So these were not the cream of the crop that, you know, everybody keeps thinking. And what ended up happening is that
when you say that, what you mean is that sometimes we think of recently arrived immigrants as what you're saying, the cream of the crop, these people who are able to become entrepreneurs and
yes, that everybody thinks that immigrants, you know, the Vietnamese or whatever, obviously they had something in them. There's something cultural about them or something genetic, and therefore that's why, you know, a lot of that community is really succeeding and that whole immigrant hope. The second, what I was mentioning is that because of the results that we saw, people felt like, well, those must be people that were already going to succeed anyway.
And so you recruited what you call people who were hopeless.
Hopeless. People that really felt that their lot in life was just to survive. Mm-hmm. You know, so they weren't in total crisis.
And that there's no way out of this, that
yeah,
we're going to be
stuck. They would
strive,
and they'd hit a ceiling again, and they'd fall back again, or they'd lose one of their kids into welfare or crisis or a gang or something like that. That's really what happened with my family.
Or the criminal justice system.
Right. And so it was my mother with two kids, and my sister ended up, you know, with the wrong group, with the wrong guy, got her pregnant at 16, took her out of the house. You know, there was abuse, you know, all kinds of problems happened with, you know. So it was everything that I was seeing with these other families. And my mother decided, I was like 6 years younger, my mother decided that's not going to happen to both kids.
Because I'm going to control what happens with Maurice much more closely?
Yes. Yeah. And so then it was kind of like, I have to take control, me as the mother.
Because otherwise the streets will take control of my kids, and
yeah.
I don't understand the streets because I'm new here.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. And even people that are old here, it's like, no, they need to have control. And, you know, parents need to have authority, and you know, you need to really allow that to happen. And if you replace parents with social workers and case managers, it really undermines that kind of familial and community authority that in third world countries people rely on because there aren't professionals.
And do you think that that's some of what's happened with this so-called war on poverty over the past 47 years?
It is kind of sad because, you know, I ran social services with case managers. I had 100 staff. I had case managers, employment specialists, you name it. And in many ways, because we were networked and my case managers were networked, then we felt that, yes, we have the better networks. We have the better knowledge than the parents. And we went in, you know, that and not really knowing that we were replacing, you know, or undermining parents. But we went in with all this knowledge feeling like we're being really helpful. And I remember watching, I had a 24-year-old social worker with an MSW, really smart. And we went into one of the household. And so my 24-year-old was giving, you know, advice to this woman who had gone through refugee camps, boat people, you know, people being killed next to her when she was crossing the Mekong River. And I was watching my 24-year-old give her advice as to what to do. And then to the side was her 13-year-old son who was looking at his mother in disgust. And I'm over there watching this kid, how his respect for his mother was going down as my 24-year-old was giving her advice. And he said something about, you know, basically it's like, why would you listen to her? And later on, the mother told me that don't ever have your social worker talk to me in front of my kids. They're losing respect for me. And, you know, her kid ended up in a gang. And this issue of, you know, having, you know, reinforcing the smarts of the parents, of the guardians, of the friends is really important. And in many ways, we come in, you know, very entitled and being very helpful, not realizing that what we've did is just undermine a community that's already vulnerable.
Right. And that is a radical notion.
And it's really hard for people that want to be helpful, which is, you know, one of the four staff that I fired. It's like they have a really hard time understanding why they were fired. It's like, no,
we're just trying to help. No, you can't. This is one of the rules of the Family Independence Initiative is that they're not allowed to give advice.
Yeah, yeah. And in many ways, then the families, you know, in Oakland, you were asking about Oakland, household income jumped 27%. African Americans, their income jumped the most.
So how did this happen?
A lot of it was because all of a sudden they had the freedom that Jerry Brown gave me. You come up with a solution. So some did side businesses. Some really strove for better jobs. Some were able to really focus on getting their kids to do better. And there was a correlation between when the parents start feeling better about themselves and or their friends start doing better, it passed on a message that their kids start feeling, you know, more secure in their household and so kids start doing better in school. Or it could have been with some that the kids start doing better in school because, you know, if you reported your kids' grades going up, then you could, again, get an award. You have recognition from the outside. All of a sudden, it has less stress on the parent. And the parents start doing better. And so it was like, it isn't a linear thing. You know, these are organic systems. A family and a community is an ecosystem that is all interactive. And so when any of these things start happening, especially in a group, when all your friends start all of a sudden thinking more positively, it's not just about survival. It's not just about the fact that I don't have something and somebody needs to bring it to me. When you start being creative and whatever, it starts bringing out this other energy. And it is that whole interactive piece that comes out when we give the families the control over the issues. And we acknowledge it. And getting acknowledgement from the outside when you got messages from the right and left basically saying that you can't do it, and all of a sudden getting this recognition, both on data, because you can see what's happening, that's what starts moving it. So household incomes jumped 27%. 9 of the 25 households bought homes. A year later, 16 of the 25 bought homes. Their kids' grades start going up. In San Francisco, 80% of the kids' grades have gone up and attendance has gone up. It's varied from every city. It's varied by every cohort and it's varied by every individual. But the patterns still come out.
And the commonality, the real radical notion here is that the experts in the field of anti-poverty are these low-income people themselves.
Yeah, of course they are. You know, it's like you and I, you know, if you have kids, they're both different. You're the one that knows that difference. You're the one that knows how to handle
it. But this is not how our social services work. This is not how any of this actually works. So how are you, Maurice Lim Miller, going to fix the poverty equation and the inequality in America? Just some short 60 seconds or less.
Well, so, you know, initially it was I ran social service. So the initial thought is, well, why don't we change service providers? Because that's the primary intervention that we have. And what became really clear is that, you know, when I ran my services, I really was dictated by my funders. That, you know, if the RFP from the request for proposals came down and said, you know, I'm interested in needs around education and kids this age, then that's what I did. And so it became really clear that funding and money is the power.
Which is still true.
It's still very true. And so for us, then, we're really trying to engage philanthropists and government, those that control resources, because if they change what they ask for, if they stop asking for, give me a particular thing around education or kids this age, but give me, if the funders would say, look, what I want to see is families take control over their lives, give them the whatever flexibility you want, collect the data. You know, if the RFPs, you know, for funding really come down in a very different way, the nonprofit sector will change.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. I'm speaking with Maurice Lim Miller, whose groundbreaking anti-poverty program, the Family Independence Initiative, has had real results across the country, starting right here in the Bay Area. I asked him what role public institutions have to play in alleviating poverty. You talked about the fact that you were really influenced by your own experience of growing up with an immigrant mom in a low-income community. But you grew up at a time that we had public investment in schools, in our universities, University of California, Berkeley, et cetera. Now we're really divesting from that public, from the commons in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think in some ways it's going to be harder. I ended up in Berkeley. It was a fluke. My mother and I didn't understand the significance of graduating from Berkeley as an engineer. But, you know, it was that there was no tuition at that time. Tuition was just starting when I went into Berkeley. At this point in time, a family in my situation can't get into Berkeley at this point. And so we're going to have other alternatives. But it isn't that other alternatives and or tuition can't be, you know, again, tweaked in some kind of way so that that opportunity. So what we need to see is, okay, so are families really striving in that kind of way and therefore change the systems to make the kinds of things that even I had available at that time available? But remember, there were all the same stereotypes. My mother used to come home and say, look, we can't speak Spanish anymore because I have to get rid of my accent, because as soon as they figure out I'm Mexican, the conversation changes. You know, the depth of questions changes, you know, and I don't get the job. And so, you know, those are the kinds of things that have existed for ages, and we still need to tackle a lot of that.
Were you able to ask your mother's advice in crafting all of this?
Well, I lost my mother in my mid-20s. And part of the reason I went into this kind of work is that I lost my mother. In many ways, I lost my sister into an abusive relationship. And her kids have really struggled because they saw all that abuse that their mother went through. And I'm the only one that kind of made it through. And after I lost my mother, I decided, you know, that I should become part of the war on poverty, because obviously there should have been, some help. My mother worked very hard, and we came to America because it was that if you worked really hard, you could make it. It didn't turn out that way. And the Family Independence Initiative, I think, would have helped my mother. You know, it's like it's the respect that she wanted. It is the access to resource based on her initiative. She wouldn't mind being tracked in terms of what she wanted people to ask her what she's good at, not what's wrong with her.
So somebody who's listening right now, what's the takeaway? How do you want us to reframe how we look at poverty and anti-poverty in this country?
In terms of people listening, you know, if they are folks that are in positions of influence and controlling resources, then a lot of it is that you're going to have to learn to trust families. You know, if you look at your own family and, yeah, you have all this dysfunction and whatever, but still the fact is, it is your family, it is your community, it's really what grounds you. You're going to have to trust another population just has less money, and you have to trust them with resources to work their way out. And you can hold them accountable the way you do your own kids and whatever, but you hold them accountable in terms of doing the right thing. You don't look at them as victims or needy or, you know, lazy or anything else. So that attitude change is really important. And if we go through that attitude change, I think then it's easier to make resources available, to break down some of the class and race and all the other issues that happen. So that's one thing. But the other audience is really the families themselves. They're going to have to step up. You know, this is their lives. Stop waiting for somebody to come save you. Don't listen to that message anymore. Really, you're going to have to be the one that pushes for the change.
So I'm low income. I'm out of work. I was employed for 20 years, let's say. I'm listening to you right now. I have basically lost hope that I'm going to be employed because I've gone to 50 job interviews this year and I still don't have a job. What do you say to me? What do you mean when you say step up?
Well, yeah, I think one of the fascinating things for me is a lot of the crux of our work has ended up this recognition of social networks. And how you have to work those social networks and how you have to build relationships. And that in many ways, then I think even with my family, that if you just stay in the social network that you're at, where everybody's just in survival mode, yeah, it's not going to work very well. And so therefore, you're going to have to step out. You're going to have to go someplace. You're going to have to try to make friends. You're going to have to try to develop the kinds of trust with other people. So you have to take care of them. They have to take care of you. So it's kind of go back to your community, go back to those networks, and then extend those networks.
Well, and our national narrative is all about bootstrapping it, right? The American dream.
Yeah, it's funny. And the bootstrapping is like, well, you have to do it by yourself. Right. And you talk to any rich people and you really find out, no, they never actually did it by themselves. So their social status, their uncle, whatever it was, right, when they actually admit it. And so there's a total change in language that needs to happen because it really reflects our attitudes towards low-income communities. As long as we keep separating ourselves from, quote, them, we'll come up with different solutions because they're not us.
You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. Today's team includes Isabel Angel, Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Panina Eilberg-Schwartz, Laura Flynn, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Moo, Ray Sue Sussman, Judy Silber, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel and produced by Casey Miner. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Something special often happens when siblings play music together. That's the case with brothers Jimmy and Vince DeWald. We've featured their former band, Buxter Hooten. Now they're going in a new direction with a band called Brand New Trash, which you're hearing right now. They say Brand New Trash is not just musical. They're trying for a more cinematic expression of a song. To find out what that means, you'll need to go to Club Amnesia in San Francisco on Thursday. Music starts about 9 p.m. All of that information is at kalw.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.